Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bryan, Judge Sarah Wheelock, Judge John Smith, the Honorable Jeffrey M. Bryan presiding. This case is A210813, State of Minnesota versus Dale Eugene McDonald.
Good morning. Good morning, counsel. Before we begin, I'd like to just run through a few things. First of all, I want to thank you for your willingness to participate today via Zoom, via remote hearing. And even though we are not in the Judicial Center, those same rules will apply today. I want to make you aware of a couple things as well. First off, there's a clock that we have, and if you have toggled the view into active speaker view, sometimes it's very difficult to see that clock and how much time is remaining. So if you're in gallery view, we find that is a little bit easier for the attorneys to see it. So make sure you're able to see it. That way you know how much time is remaining. Also, if you would please mute yourselves when you're not speaking. And before you begin your argument, if you would state your name and the party you represent, because we are recording these, making an audio recording of these proceedings today. And finally, we understand from time to time there may be disruptions, interruptions, pets, doorbells, kids. And we also understand that there might be technical problems. So we will do our best to keep those to a minimum, but understand that those do happen. We will try to accommodate you if there is a problem and make sure that you have all the time to which you're entitled this morning. And with that, we'll turn to you, Mr. Cattell. You prepared to proceed?
Yes. Thank you, Your Honor. Opposing counsel, and may it please the court. My name is Max Kittle. I'm an attorney with the state public defender. I represent appellant Dale McDonald in this matter. At a sentencing hearing, Mr. McDonald received ineffective assistance of counsel. Trial counsel's performance fell below an objective standard of reasonableness when he failed to explain the plea withdrawal standards to his client and did not move for pre-sentence plea withdrawal after his client indicated that is what he wanted to do. Second, when a departure motion was promised in the plea petition, counsel failed to file or argue for a downward durational departure. We ask that Mr. McDonald be allowed to withdraw his plea and proceed to trial, or at a minimum, remand to the district court to allow Mr. McDonald to make a motion to withdraw his plea under the fair and just standard. In the alternative, we ask the matter be remanded to the district court to allow for Mr. McDonald to move for a downward durational departure. All too often, we hear from clients that it feels like everyone in the legal system is against them. Even their own attorneys are against them. That everyone is on the same side. This is a striking case where I read the sentencing transcript and agree. It feels like everyone in the courtroom was on the same side. Everyone in the courtroom kind of knew the outcome that was coming. And everyone knew what was going to happen except for Mr. McDonald. First, as to plea withdrawal, before sentencing, Mr. McDonald told his attorney that he wanted to withdraw his plea. Now, I'm going to quote directly from the transcript because opposing counsel suggests that the record is not complete and that more fact-finding is required. I do disagree, because an evidentiary hearing would essentially go something like this anyways. I'd ask counsel, did you explain the new recommendations from probation to Mr. McDonald? Quote, I advised Mr. McDonald of the change in the recommendation in the PSI. And how did Mr. McDonald respond? Quote, Mr. McDonald indicated to me at that point he would then like to withdraw his plea. Did counsel explain the standard? Quote, I very shortly explained to him that's going to be an incredibly high mountain to climb if that's even available. So did he explain the standards for plea withdrawal pre and post sentencing and explain that it was going to be just as in Anderson, that it would be tougher to withdraw your plea after sentencing? Quote, I didn't go through the whole threshold amount of what's got to be shown. Did he make a motion for plea withdrawal? From the record, it is clear no motion was made on the record or before the sentencing hearing. And did he request a continuance or explain the options or explain the standards to Mr. McDonald? No, counsel stated on the record, quote, I didn't go through the whole threshold amount of what's got to be shown, but I think we are ready to proceed on the calendar nonetheless. This court in Anderson found that where trial counsel advised his client to wait until after sentencing to file a plea withdrawal motion, that without explaining the differences in the pre and post plea standards for plea withdrawal, that Ms. Anderson was deprived of her ability to bring a motion that would be decided on the fair and just standard. The same is true here. Mr. McDonald clearly indicated to his attorney that he wanted to go forward with a motion on plea withdrawal.
So I have a quick question about Anderson for you, because as I read that, the way that this that prejudice was addressed, to say that we have no way of knowing what the outcome would have been or whether it would have been different because no motion was made. Do you think Anderson changes the burden from showing prejudice to showing the possibility of prejudice?
Anderson certainly suggests that they have no way of showing whether or not the district court would have considered the fair and just reasons Ms. Anderson might have presented and how the district court would have weighed those. The same is certainly true here. We don't know how the district court would have addressed the fair and just reasons that Mr. McDonald may have presented. There's certainly a strong possibility, and in my opinion, in my reading of the record, that there are fair and just reasons for plea withdrawal. And you can
before we get to that, though, I'm just trying to get your understanding of Anderson a little bit, right? It could be that this court decided because we can't determine, we need to let these facts get developed, as opposed to actually changing the standard. Normally, it's Pellin's burden to show prejudice, right? But instead of showing prejudice. Do you believe that Anderson has changed that so that the appellant needs to only show the possibility of prejudice when there was no motion made below?
More so the former, that the record, we didn't know. We didn't have any idea of whether or not the district court would apply or how they would analyze fair and just reasons and what fair and just reasons Ms. Anderson may have presented. In this case, I believe the record is more developed in the fact that there are fair and just reasons that you can find throughout the record that show Mr. McDonald is entitled to plea withdrawal. And I would say first and foremost that he got nothing for his plea. It was a straight plea. And the plea petition specifically stated the attorney would argue for a departure. Of course, the attorney doesn't argue for a departure. No charges were dismissed. There was no aggravated sentences. There were no additional charges or additional cases that were dismissed as a basis of Mr. McDonald's plea. It was solely that he was promised he was going to have a chance to argue for a departure and that he would be allowed to go to treatment. He did get to go to treatment, but short of that, he got nothing out of this plea. There are several other things that Mr. McDonald, I believe, would present as fair and just reasons, and that, again, you can find in the record.
In terms of that determination, right, there was no motion made. So we don't know what the district court would have done had the motion been made. But as we're looking at it to determine whether or not remand would be appropriate or there's a need to develop more facts or whether there is even the possibility of fair and just reasons being there, I think you're asking this court to consider the weight that statements that Mr. McDonald's statements during the plea colloquy should have, right? You're not saying that he wasn't adequately advised that he, you know, the court's only going to accept a guilty plea if he is in fact guilty. You're not saying that he didn't in the plea colloquy acknowledge guilt. He's not, you know, so there are some statements that necessarily are inconsistent with a request to withdraw from the plea. So what weight are you asking us to give to the statements Mr. McDonald made during the plea colloquy that would be inconsistent with a request to withdraw?
And I would lean on that fair and just standard. There may be fair and just reasons outside of specifically the plea petition or the plea colloquy that would compel a district court to allow plea withdrawal and exercise their discretion and allow plea withdrawal. Specifically, I would go back to the fact that he was and it does play a little bit into both. The fact that the attorney didn't argue for a departure, didn't file a departure motion when a downward durational departure was clearly something Mr. McDonald was eligible for and that he certainly could have argued for at the very minimum, goes to the fact that he didn't have effective assistance counsel throughout this case. He pled guilty with the promise that a departure was going to be argued for. He didn't get that. And that aspect of him not receiving that aspect of the plea certainly goes towards not only the ineffective assistance counsel for the plea withdrawal motion, but also for the downward durational departure. And again, I want to stress Mr. McDonald is certainly eligible to be considered for a downward durational departure. Most evidenced by the most evidenced by the fact that the judge in this case did go to the bottom of the box. So clearly there was some reason that the district court thought this crime was less serious than the typical third degree burglary.
Mr. Kittle, and I apologize. I think I made your name more French than it is.
That's okay. It was kind of nice. No, it okay. Was nice.
Mr. Kittle. Go ahead. Please, Judge.
You indicated that the defendant didn't get anything for his plea, but didn't he get the opportunity to go to treatment and to be successful there? And wasn't that part of the consideration in giving him the furlough and part of the consideration for his plea that if he successfully completed that would be considered in a downward departure?
That's correct, Your Honor. And I'm sure the state will bring that up as well and argue that he did state it in the colloquy and in the petition. He wasn't pleading guilty solely to get out of jail. But the fact of the matter was he made several bail motions before. Again, he was homeless, so he wasn't going to be able to afford any bail. He made three bail motions. All were denied. And immediately after the plea colloquy, the judge indicates that he will grant a furlough request and allow him to go to treatment. Now, again, that's the only thing essentially Mr. McDonald gets out of this plea. No charges are dismissed, no aggravated sentences, no other cases were attached to this plea. And the other big thing in that plea petition is that an attorney is going to argue for a departure for him. And that doesn't happen.
Didn't it make it more difficult that he didn't successfully complete treatment?
Absolutely.
I think that's the problem you have, is that part of the reason for the plea was that everybody contemplated that he would successfully complete treatment and then he might get a departure. But having failed that, he put himself in a very difficult position.
Absolutely. And that was certainly the hope of everyone, including the court. And I think that's clear in the sentencing transcript as well. In the sentencing transcript, everybody's focus, the state, probation, and the district court, their entire focus is on Mr. McDonald's conduct between the plea and sentencing. All those factors that would normally go towards a dispositional departure. It isn't until the public defender, the trial counsel, begins making sort of a quasi-argument, I guess, basically against a dispositional departure. Then the attorney starts to argue against a durational departure, and you can almost, reading the transcript, see the wheels start turning in his head. And he says, well, maybe something like that does go to the issue of intent. And then he states, if I were going to bring a departure motion, I should ask for a continuance. I would have to get the input from the state and probation. Of course, the attorney doesn't get any input on the record, doesn't get any input off the record, doesn't have any conversations with the client about a continuance, and essentially turns it back over to the district court without requesting a continuance to file that durational departure. You can really see the attorney's kind of wheels moving, saying, I probably should have filed a durational departure motion. He might be eligible for a durational departure. But without making that request for a continuance, without speaking to Mr. McDonald about what the factors for a durational departure are, we know that he didn't explain the plea withdrawal standards. It's not hard to assume that he didn't explain the durational departure standards to Mr. McDonald either, what would need to be shown, or whether it might make sense to file that durational departure motion. He just kind of turns it back over to the district court. And of course, the district court imposes a guideline sentence, bottom of the box, and only brings up reasons related to a dispositional departure again, nothing in regards to a durational departure. So if Mr. McDonald would have had a trial counsel to present that durational departure motion, to make all those strong arguments, again, that he was homeless, that he went into this garage, not a home, went into the garage, went through the window, accidentally broke some items, which is the only reason this arises to a felony level offense, and was found in the garage minutes later, immediately dropped to his knees, is tackled by the homeowner and punched by the homeowner, and waits there patiently for the cops to come. All those factors would go towards a durational departure. The judge obviously saw that this crime was at least somewhat less serious than the normal, based on him going to the bottom of the box. But it's certainly a reasonable probability that the district court would consider all of those factors and go lower than the bottom of the box if a durational departure motion was presented. Again, I do believe the record here is complete. The statements made by trial counsel certainly show that he provided an effective assistance to the counsel. He was told by... Yes, sir.
There are times when a prudent district court judge will step in if essentially to prompt a motion from defense counsel who might be otherwise ineffective, such as at the end of the state's case, if there's no motion for a directed verdict or something like that. Are we essentially adding this scenario to the list of times when a prudent district court judge will step in and prompt a motion at every sentencing hearing to make sure that the defendant still wants to be to have pled guilty, right? Doesn't want to change that or withdraw from that by making the conclusion or the remedy that you're asking. Aren't we requiring judges to then make motions for defense counsel at every sentencing when there was a plea?
Specifically in this case, the first paragraph, the first thing that's said on the record is the defense attorney stepping in and saying, I told my client there's new recommendations from the PSI. He indicated to me at that point, I want to withdraw my plea. To move forward after hearing that my client wants to withdraw his plea, and counsel specifically stating, I didn't explain the standards to him. I quickly said, it's going to be tough, but I didn't explain the standards to him. To move forward based on that, I put it on counsel for counsel not making the motion, not arguing for plea withdrawal for his client when that's clearly what his client wanted. I see my time has run out, though. I will reserve the rest of my argument for rebuttal, please.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Go ahead, counsel, for respondent.
Thank you, and good morning, your honors. May it please the court. My name is Nick Hajdukovic. I'm an assistant Washington County attorney. I represent the respondent, state of Minnesota. The respondent is asking this court to affirm the appellant's conviction for third-degree burglary and remand for the sole purpose of awarding 3 additional days of jail credit. Simply put, appellant has failed to satisfy either prong, much less both prongs of the Strickland test for either of his 2 claims of ineffective assistance of counsel. And I'd like to begin with the plea withdrawal issue. First of all, I think I can't emphasize this enough. The fact that this claim was raised on direct appeal without a petition for post-conviction relief means that essentially we have to take the record as it exists after the time of sentencing. There was no opportunity to further develop a record. So the burden unambiguously falls on the appellant to demonstrate both of these prongs, both ineffective assistance and prejudice. And so given the record as it exists, the appellant simply cannot make that showing. And I think that on the plea withdrawal issue, the easiest way to deal with this question is simply to look at the prejudice prong, because there's only one theory.
Mr. Hajdukovic, if I could jump in before you do that, I'm concerned about the impact that Anderson has on the prejudice prong of Strickland. In Anderson, there wasn't enough to show prejudice. And yet, for that reason, because we were in no position to make a determination, it was remanded. So wouldn't that change the Strickland prejudice prong?
I don't think so. And I do agree that there is some language in Anderson that could suggest what you're saying, Judge Brian. So I certainly get where you're coming from on that. But on the other hand, I think if we look at, first of all, decades of precedent, generally speaking, on ineffective assistance of counsel claim, I have to think that if this court was trying to make sort of an exception or more of a structural error type, sort of digging its own little hole for this specific type of case, this making a new category, I think it would have said so. And Anderson is a very, it's different from this case, despite counsel's numerous claims, in that there we have it's not quite an affirmative misrepresentation by counsel, but pretty close to it.
Let's just start with the prejudice part of it, right? I don't see too many differences between the ability for Ms. Anderson to show prejudice when there was no motion, and the ability here of Mr. McDonald to do the same when, again, there's no motion. It seems like either Anderson was wrong not to find prejudice, or the standard is changed.
Well, my response to that would be that there was a motion in Anderson. It was just brought after sentencing. And what this court ultimately held in Anderson was the district court, I believe in Anderson, found no manifest injustice after in the post-sentencing motion to withdraw. And essentially they said, well, we don't know what the court would have found had that motion instead been made before, when counsel essentially misrepresented, maybe misrepresented isn't the right word, but provided very, very poor advice to his client about the when the client should potentially make a motion to withdraw a guilty plea. So I think that's the big difference, is that there was actually a motion made in Anderson. And I think that makes some level of sense for that distinction to be significant, because here, I guess it's frankly not clear to me, just on a purely procedural note, if this court were to remand, I guess it'd be an odd remand in the sense that there's no order that the court is revisiting, because there was no motion at all. The motion in Anderson was made at the wrong time, but there was a motion and there was a ruling by the district court. Here, there's no motion whatsoever, therefore no ruling. And therefore, I guess it's remanding to allow the appellant to file a motion to withdraw his plea under the fair and just standard. But
Mr. Hajdukovic, excuse me. So if there is no record before us on the prejudice portion, wouldn't it make sense to remand so that there can be a record created?
Not in this particular context. And the reason for that is typically, and I cited this case in my brief, Roby, it's in footnote one of that case, the Supreme Court quotes a previous opinion where it notes that ineffective assistance of claims are typically made in the context of a post-conviction petition, where a district court judge can then evaluate the claims, hold an evidentiary hearing if necessary, and essentially further develop the record. Because as the Supreme Court observed in Roby, a lot of times ineffective assistance of counsel claims deal with things that are not set or not part of the record. Here, the appellant made the decision to file a direct appeal instead of a petition for post-conviction relief. There's nothing to remand because there's no order that is being challenged here. This is, I think, a good example of why a petition for post-conviction relief is far more frequently seen in this context, because there the appellant can again develop the factual record further. So can the state, frankly, because there may be reasons counsel doesn't do something. And those don't appear in the record either, unless the record is further supplemented. I mean, there's a lot of times when counsel sits silent on something or doesn't make a motion, doesn't ask a question of a witness, for example, and it may look on paper like, why would you not do that? But counsel often has a very good reason for not doing it strategically. And so that's why we typically would see these claims brought via post-conviction petition. The district court then has the opportunity to evaluate credibility, make findings of fact, and then ultimately that can be appealed to this court if the defendant is not satisfied with the outcome.
So Mr. Hajdukovic, if you could explain to me what you believe then that Mr. McDonald's attorney's obligation was when he did indicate on the record that his client wanted to withdraw his plea. What was his obligation then at that point?
I think that's actually a really interesting question that I've been thinking a lot about, because I think there's a couple of things. One, to me, it's not clear from the record whether it's clear that the appellant, Mr. McDonald, stated that he wanted to withdraw his plea when he was speaking with counsel before the sentencing hearing. It's not entirely clear to me if that desire remained after their conversation was complete. It's possible that after further consultation, he didn't want to withdraw his plea. But assuming for the sake of argument that he did continue to want to withdraw his plea, you know, I think this raises a really fascinating question, because I guess the attorney could bring it to the court's attention, but I also don't know that there's any authority for requiring an attorney to make a motion if the attorney feels like there is no adequate basis in fact or law to make the motion. I think it becomes sort of an ethical issue. It's ultimately the defendant's decision, obviously, whether to plead guilty or not after hearing advice from counsel. And counsel can and should advise a client interested in possibly withdrawing a plea on that issue.
And how should we evaluate the fact that on the record, he states, I didn't go through the whole threshold amount of what's got to be shown, but let's proceed nonetheless, and did not ask for a break to offer additional counsel to his client to just essentially take the time to go through that process, advise his client, and then come back on the record.
Well, again, I think we are in a difficult position here because of the lack of a developed factual record, which again is really the appellant's decision not to further develop the record. And so that does put us in a more difficult situation than we would otherwise be in if we had a fully developed record. I certainly would agree with that. But, you know, in terms of what should the attorney have done in that situation, again, to me, it's not clear that Mr. McDonald, the client, still wanted to withdraw the plea by the time the hearing started. So maybe there was nothing further to do. And again, I think if we look at the prejudice prong, Judge Meslow also made clear, you know, I can't fathom a basis to withdraw the plea. And again, looking at the state of the record here, the appellant has really given us only one possible basis, which was Mr. McDonald wanted to get out of jail. But again, that's contradicted by his sworn statement.
Mr. Idukovich, I'm not sure that's the only basis I'm able to determine. I think it is pretty clear at the time that the plea was entered, the hope, right, that he would be successful. So the question then becomes whether or not he was aware at the time of the plea of the consequences of failing to progress through treatment successfully. And if he's not aware of those consequences for sentencing, right, the consequences that would have on his sentencing, then I think there might be a fair and just reason. Would you agree?
If he's not aware of the consequences, then it's at least arguable that then what we have is really an unintelligent plea. And then
okay, all right. Well, a plea can be unintelligent because someone wasn't informed of their rights. At the same time, that there's an ineffective assistance counsel to the attorney on the attorney for or claim that the attorney didn't advise him of those rights. So many times you see both the Fifth and Sixth Amendment going forward. Why wouldn't the Sixth Amendment at least be available here, saying he should have been advised of something that he wasn't advised of, and that for that reason, there's a fair and just reason to withdraw?
Well, again, I think that may have been a legitimate argument, but counsel hasn't raised it. And again, it's on counsel as the appellant to show an effective assistance of counsel. It's their burden to show both of those two prongs under Strickland. And if appellant fails to raise the issue, and again, it was the appellant's decision to proceed in this with this particular procedural mechanism, a direct appeal rather than a post-conviction petition. That's possibly a legitimate argument, Your Honor. I can't say out of hand that it's not, but it hasn't been raised here. And so I don't feel like I'm in a position to respond on the merits. And what I again get back to is on the Anderson case, because that might be part of your thought process, Your Honor, again, on that case, is that it would just seem odd to me that this court in Anderson would sort of have carved out this exception to the Strickland rule without explicitly saying that that's what it was doing. I think that case had a very unique and unusual posture. There was actually a motion raised, like I said, and so in that sense, I think this case is different, and I think the court should just apply the standard Strickland rule. I wanted to briefly touch on the departure issue as well, just to touch on a couple things that counsel raised during his argument. One is that counsel puts a lot of weight, for example, on the plea petition, which states that the defense, quote, will argue for a departure, end quote. And counsel says, well, a durational departure is also a departure. That's true, but the context of the entire hearing made very clear that the contemplated departure was the dispositional departure to probation if the appellant was successful in treatment. I think when the court reads that, as well as there was a subsequent hearing held on August 7th of 2020, the transcript of that is in the record. At that hearing, the judge, where I think Mr. McDonald had already not successfully completed one treatment program, but may have been in the process of getting into another program, the judge is again clear that, you know, he doesn't want to send him to prison. They're talking about dispositional departures, not durational departures. Nobody talked about durational departures until defense counsel's offhand remark at the time of sentencing. And with regard to that remark, counsel made about, you know, I don't know if Mr. McDonald wants me to get a continuance and try to seek a durational departure. Mr. McDonald did speak after that. He did not say that he wanted counsel to do that. And in fact, there's some evidence to suggest that Mr. McDonald may not have wanted a durational departure, which might sound somewhat silly on its face, because you might think, why wouldn't someone want a shorter sentence? But at the very end of the sentencing transcript, Mr. McDonald asked Judge Meslow, essentially, did I get what he called a standard sentence, meaning a presumptive sentence in legal terms? And it seems like his concern there is he going to be eligible for programming during his time at the Department of Corrections, because my understanding is certain programming may not be available to people who are there for only a shorter period. So there's at least some suggestion he didn't want it. And again, I'm not claiming that the record is unambiguously shows that he didn't want a downward durational departure. But again, simply pointing out that the burden is on the appellant here. They failed to meet that burden. And in fact, there is some evidence that the appellant may not have even wanted that downward durational departure.
Mr. Hajdukovic, is it your argument that this defendant would and should know the difference between a downward dispositional departure and a downward durational departure, and be able in that moment to articulate the desire for the latter?
I don't know that I'd expect him to know the terminology. I mean, I don't know that that's a fair expectation to place on a non-lawyer. But my point is that he does certainly have plenty of experience in the criminal justice system, and his entire request to Judge Meslow, Mr. McDonald's request, that is, was, as I read the context of it, in his allocution for a dispositional departure, not a durational departure. He's asking essentially not to go to prison. He's saying, don't set me back, or something to that effect, which would indicate a request not to go to prison.
Is it possible that the reason he didn't ask for it is because he did not know that that type of departure existed?
Your Honor, I see my time has expired. May I answer the question?
Please do.
Thank you. I can't deny that it's impossible, Your Honor. But again, the problem is we have this undeveloped factual record here. As I said, I think there's some evidence to suggest that he knew what it meant, or he didn't want a durational departure, regardless of whether he understood the precise terminology. But again, that's on the appellant to meet that burden. And given this procedural context, the appellant certainly has not met that burden. So I'd ask this court to affirm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Kittle.
Thank you, Your Honor. And I will start off by saying opposing counsel certainly relies on the idea throughout his brief and today that the record isn't developed enough. Number one, I know that this court does remand for post-conviction proceedings if it doesn't believe the ineffective assistance of counsel claim is developed enough. If that's how this court feels, then we'd ask that you do remand for post-conviction on the ineffective. But again, it's not necessary because the record here is so developed on its face, starting with the plea withdrawal.
No, let me jump in because I'm still trying to figure out how we should be applying Anderson and what it means. There are definitely times when an attorney, by their affirmative conduct, does something that might fall below reasonable expectations. But when an attorney fails to do something, and we're asking whether that failure to do something is ineffective, don't we need to know the reasons why that wasn't done? For example, was it trial strategy? Was there some reason why trial counsel refrains from doing something? In order to know that the answers to those questions, many times you do need a hearing. So I guess the question is, when we're addressing an attorney's failure to do something, and there is not a post-conviction motion that would allow a hearing, evidentiary hearing, to develop that record, what is the prejudice that an appellant, what does that burden look like for an appellant?
I would argue that Anderson does apply in that situation as well. The biggest problem in Anderson was number one, the advice that she should wait to file a plea withdrawal motion because it would be better to simply argue for a lower sentence and it might frustrate a judge to get a plea withdrawal motion. The big issue in Anderson came when the attorney failed to tell his client that it was going to be a different standard pre-sentence versus post-sentence. And so Anderson was deprived of that opportunity to have a fair and just plea withdrawal motion. The same is true here. And I will talk about the strategy as well, because I think that's important. There's absolutely no strategy that could possibly be in place in this situation. On the plea withdrawal, the strategy in Anderson was, let's not frustrate the judge and hopefully we can get a lesser sentence. Here, the first thing out of the attorney's mouth is that his client now wants to withdraw his plea. There's no secret. There's no, hey, maybe if you don't say anything about plea withdrawal, we might have a better shot at a lower sentence. No, it's the first thing that the attorney tells the judge. My client wants to withdraw his plea. And as far as a durational departure, there's certainly no strategy for that either. I think all of your honors pointed out, there's not a benefit to him going to prison for a shorter period of time. At no time was Mr. McDonald saying, hey, I don't want to go to prison for a year. I'd rather go for 2 years or anything like that. All of the arguments he was making were about the conduct that day, which would go to the durational, and the conduct that he had in between the plea and sentencing, which would go to a dispositional. So Mr. McDonald on his own did state a whole lot of facts in his kind of colloquy during sentencing that would support a dispositional, but would also support a durational departure. So he was making those arguments both, and it certainly wouldn't be fair to expect the defendant to know the difference. And while his attorney is kind of saying, I don't know if I could make a durational, here's maybe a reason for a durational, maybe I should request a continuance, maybe I should talk to my client about it. It's on the attorney. It's the attorney's job to make the motions. It's the attorney's job to make the plea withdrawal motion. It's the attorney's job to make the departure motion, not the client's. For the state to put that on the client to say, hey, he should have spoken up and said, I want a continuance. I want to file a durational a durational departure motion, is taking that burden and that duty off the attorney and shifting it on to the client. So was the strategy? I don't believe so. There's simply no basis to, and in looking at this record on its face, it is sufficient to show that counsel's performance did fall below a reasonable standard and based on Anderson and the durational departure motion, that certainly did prejudice him. If I don't have any other questions, I will just wrap up and ask that this court either remand for a trial or remand for a hearing on a plea withdrawal motion or remand for a hearing on a durational departure motion. And if this court feels that the record for a finding of ineffective assistance isn't complete enough to make a ruling, I say you remand for post-conviction proceedings on these ineffective assistance of counsel issues. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We will take the matter under advisement and issue an opinion within the statutory timeframe.